Hello, welcome again. My name is Celeste Choate. I'm one of the associate directors here at the Ann Arbor District Library, and this is?
Hello, I'm Doreen Markle. I'm the associate director at the Michigan Institute for Clinical and Health Research at the University of Michigan.
And the reason that Doreen and I are up here together to give you a quick introduction tonight is that the Ann Arbor District Library and MISHR and the U of M Health Sciences Libraries together received a grant from the National Institutes of Health. It's called a Partners in Research Grant, and it combines a community partner, the library, with a research institution, the University of Michigan, to provide a better impact in the public arena, whether it's by direct research or community forums and direct research like we're doing here now. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about that project. We are trying here and having this series of forums on different health topics to raise awareness in the public of what is out there available to you regarding clinical research, what it can do for you, and hopefully what you can do for clinical research if you are so interested. There's a wonderful website called Engage, and it's through the University of Michigan. And if you are interested in, they had some slides up before, the website is umengage.org, and they have flyers about it outside on the table. You can register on the website and take a look and see what type of clinical research is available right now going on that you could participate in if you are so inclined. So if you're interested, please do that. We are very interested in having you here tonight and asking questions. And so please make sure that you write them down. Complete your surveys, which are an important part of our grant, finding out whether or not these community forums help raise awareness and help answer questions that you have about clinical research. And if you are interested in participating in a focus group about this, we would really like to have you do so. So I will pass the microphone over to Doreen.
I think, as was mentioned earlier, the questionnaires you have a few questions you answer before the presentation and then questions you answer again at the end. So if you can take a moment while I'm providing introductions to take a look at that. It only takes, I think, less than 30 seconds to answer. So it's our pleasure this evening during Heart Healthy Month and a focus on heart healthy issues in women to have Dr. Lewis Morgenstern with us, who's going to speak about stroke in women. Dr. Morgenstern is the director of the stroke program and the medical director of the stroke unit at the University of Michigan Health System. He is a professor of neurology, emergency medicine, and neurosurgery at the U of M, and a professor of epidemiology at the U of M School of Public Health. He received his medical degree from the University of Michigan with distinction in research and did his neurology residency at Johns Hopkins Hospital and then a stroke fellowship that followed at the University of Texas in Houston. Dr. Morgenstern is an NIH-funded principal investigator in studies that aim to reduce stroke health disparities with respect to race, ethnicity, and gender. His research group has published many studies identifying gender-specific disparities with respect to stroke symptoms and differences in the quality of stroke care. Dr. Morgenstern's other research focus is on the treatment of intracerebral hemorrhage and mobilizing healthcare professionals and communities to treat stroke acute ischemic stroke. He has an extensive publication record as well. Dr. Morgenstern is also a fellow of the American Academy of Neurology and the American Heart Association and a member of the editorial board of a journal called Stroke. So you can see that he is certainly an expert in this field, and we are really delighted that he has taken the time this evening to be with us. Dr. Morgenstern.
So thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. I'd like to thank MISHR and the Ann Arbor District Library for sponsoring this event, and I'd like to thank all of you for coming out tonight in this relatively chilly evening to learn a little bit about stroke and share some of your ideas with me. So the format is that I'm going to give a presentation of probably about 50 minutes or so that kind of introduces various aspects of stroke, tells you a little bit about the research that we and others have done specifically related to stroke in women. And as you'll learn, stroke seems to have a propensity, unfortunately, for women, and there is many very important gender differences with respect to this disease that are worth knowing about. And then when we're done, I am happy to answer your questions, hear your comments, and make this as interactive as possible. So this is how I got started in this business. This remarkably adorable child is me, many, many, many decades ago. And seriously, the really remarkable person in this photo is this person here, who is my grandmother. And I grew up in a small apartment in Midtown Manhattan. And my grandmother was an immigrant from Eastern Europe, had a very thick accent, and was really very instrumental in raising me. And when I was 12 years old, she had a stroke that I now know affected the left side of her brain. It made this very brilliant, eloquent woman not be able to speak. She was paralyzed on the right side of her body. And she had those deficits for a couple months. She had another stroke, and she passed away. And that was obviously a big impact on me. And I'm sure that just about everybody in this room has had a personal experience with either yourself or people that you know and love having stroke. It's an incredibly common disease. And the interesting thing about stroke is that it's arguably the most preventable and most treatable of all catastrophic conditions. We know a lot about this disease, and we still do very little at preventing it or treating it. So the knowledge is there, but the behavior to get it done has not really matched. And so that's really important. So I'm not going to talk a lot about the risk factors for stroke and stroke prevention, although I'd be more than happy to answer your questions later on about that. But there are some aspects on this slide here that tells you about the risk factors for stroke. So this was our cigarette case here in my house, and the heart-shaped ashtray, which is really kind of an oxymoron. But the other risk factors are heart disease, high blood pressure, and the number one risk factor for stroke. Diabetes is very, very important as well. So the facts about stroke. Stroke is the number one cause of adult disability in the United States. It's the number one reason that people end up in nursing homes. It's the third leading cause of death in the U.S. and really all Western countries. There are 720,000 strokes each year in the United States. As I've said, it's very treatable and very preventable. And for us as researchers, it's a very good model disease. It's common, it's severe, and it has a predilection for populations that are at high risk and which we could do something about with proper therapy and proper aggressive treatment. So there are three types of stroke. I'm going to take you through the first year of medical school here in the next 5 minutes. And so this is the most common type of stroke. It occurs in 85% of patients. And this is like if you were looking at my brain straight on, okay? And this is the normal part of the brain over here. And this part, as you see, that's kind of red and black down here and ugly looking, has had a stroke. All right, and that part of the brain has died. So what a stroke is, when we use that term, is that blood cannot get to part of the brain. And as you know, blood brings oxygen and sugar and nutrients. And when part of the brain is robbed of that, it dies. Okay, and so a stroke is a little bit of the brain dying. And depending upon the location and the artery that is bringing blood, it can be small or it can be big. This is actually a pretty big one. And so this is the most common type of stroke called cerebral infarction in 85%. Now, when you come to the emergency department with stroke symptoms, the first thing we do is get a CAT scan. And what we're looking for is this. And this is the normal side over here. And this is the abnormal side over here. And you'll have to take my word for it, but this side is full of water. It's swollen and doesn't have the clear demarcation that you can see over here. And when we see something like this, we know that the brain has been very badly injured, in this case by a stroke. And so that's the purpose of imaging. We have a lot of different ways to image the brain. This is a CAT scan. As you know, CAT scans have been around for decades. A more powerful tool that we have is MRI scans. And there are all other. There's a bunch of other types of imaging as well. But predominantly, CT scans and MRIs are what we do. The second type of stroke, which occurs in 10% of patients, and one that is a particularly bad type, is called an intracerebral hemorrhage. And that's, instead of having the blood vessel get clogged up, like the previous type I told you about, this is where the blood vessel actually ruptures, and bleeding goes into the brain. And what you can see here is blood that has gotten into the brain. This is the normal side over here, and this is the abnormal side. And the surrounding area that's pink here is angry. It's swollen and not very happy. And that's what happens in an intracerebral hemorrhage. And on a CAT scan, that looks bright white. So when you look at a CAT scan, it doesn't look red for blood. It looks white. And so this area all around here is blood that doesn't belong there. The third type of stroke is called a subarachnoid hemorrhage. It's the rarest type. It results from a rupture of an aneurysm. And an aneurysm is a blister on the artery, and it can break open and cause leakage of blood all around the brain. And so here's a little diagram of that. Here's the artery at the base of the brain. It's had a little blister. It ruptured, and the blood has kind of leaked over here. So this is like a drawing. And on a CAT scan, you guys all now know the radiology of this. Blood is bright white on a CAT scan. And this classic star-shaped pattern is what we see in a subarachnoid hemorrhage. None of that belongs there. This is all blood. For those of you that are wondering, what's all that white stuff on the outside? That's the normal skull, okay? So calcium is what causes things to be white in this particular circumstance. So this is normal, but this is not normal. Okay, so that's the easy stuff. Now let's get into the complex research about women and stroke. And so these are the questions that I hope to answer this evening. Is stroke an important disease in women? Obviously, I wouldn't be standing here unless the answer was yes. Are the symptoms of stroke the same in both men and women? Are men and women allocated the same healthcare resources to prevent and treat stroke? Do men and women have the same stroke outcomes? How can we deliver better stroke care for women? So that's what we're going to discuss. So is stroke an important disease for women? Absolutely. And so this was one of the first papers that I ever wrote. And you don't have to read any of the small print. This is just a marker for me to kind of show you what our research papers look like and for you to just see the headline. So I'm going to show you a lot of slides like that. If you just read the headline, that would be perfect. So we did a study back in the years that I lived in Texas, and we were interested in trying to figure out who had the most stroke, African Americans, Hispanic Americans, or non-Hispanic whites. And we found, as others have found at that time and since, that African Americans have a dramatically high rate of stroke. It's actually a medical tragedy, the amount of stroke that occurs in the African American community, and something that we really need to do something about. We also found, somewhat serendipitously, that women have a very, very high rate of stroke. And so in this study, we use vital statistics, that is data on people who have died from stroke. And we did this study back in the late 80s and early 90s, and we found that 61% of all strokes deaths occur in women. And right now, the national average is 62%. So across the United States, 62% of all deaths from stroke occur in women. Okay, so it's obviously a very important disease. The second question that I have to answer is, are the symptoms of stroke the same in both men and women? And we've actually done a lot of research on this issue, and we're still not sure about that. We think that they are commonalities, but there also are differences. And so the first bit of work we did was in a relatively rural part of East Texas. And we did a study comparing the symptoms of stroke in men and women who lived in this community. And so there were a lot of patients in the study, 1,124 from 1998 to 2000. And we found that the symptoms of stroke were different. So the traditional stroke symptoms, the ones that we learned about in medical school and the ones that you hear about from the federal government, are weakness and numbness on one side of the body, and I'll come back to these at the end of the talk as well. But weakness and numbness on one side of the body, difficulty speaking or understanding, sudden unexplained confusion, sudden unexplained falling. So like my grandmother, who was unable to speak and couldn't move one side of her body, that's a very classic stroke symptom. So we found that men and women have those common stroke symptoms, but women also have something else. They had more of what we labeled as non-traditional stroke symptoms, and those were pain in a part of the body and a change in consciousness. And these were reported more by women, okay? Now, it turns out in this study that the women had more of that bleeding type of stroke that I told you about earlier than the men did. And some of these symptoms are kind of more common to the bleeding type of stroke than they are to the infarction, the more common type of stroke. So we said, I don't know, maybe this is one of the many strange things about Texas, or maybe this is something about this study. We need to try to figure this out by doing it again. Okay, so one key aspect of good clinical research is that you never believe your first finding, right? You got to do it again. You got to do it in a different population. And so we did it in a different population. We did it in Ann Arbor, okay? And so this was a study that was just published last year by my colleague Linda Elizabeth and our group, where we looked at patients who came to the University of Michigan Emergency Department who had a stroke, and we found what their symptoms were. We compared men and women with symptoms. And actually, we did this study a lot better than the Texas study because we went immediately to the emergency department when the patients came. We interviewed them right away, and so we got the information in a much more believable fashion. And so, interestingly, again, there were 461 patients, 224 women, 237 men, and we found the same thing again. Very interestingly, non-traditional symptoms were reported more commonly by women than men. Not a huge amount, but nonetheless a significant difference of 8%. And the things that we found especially were that altered mental status, kind of a change in consciousness or just not quite being with it, was more common in women than men. That's a relatively rare symptom. Usually when people have stroke, they're awake and they may have problems speaking, they may be confused, but they're not sleepy, they're not losing consciousness. And so this was something that was more common in women than men by 8%. So that is something to note. So what we say now is that the symptoms, the traditional symptoms, can happen in both men and women. Weakness and numbness on one side of the body, difficulty speaking or understanding, sudden unexplained falling, sudden unexplained clumsiness. But this additional stuff of kind of not quite being with it, falling asleep, passing out, and perhaps some pain can also be a symptom in women. All right? It's a picture of my eldest daughter 15 years ago, actually. So the next question is there a gender difference in healthcare resource allocation? That is, are we spending more medical services? Are we doing more to evaluate men than we are for women? And the answer to that, and this was a pretty shocking thing for us, is yes, really big time. Except if you live in Canada, and I put in the really for this audience. Usually when I talk in other places, just saying Canada envisions cold, but so does Michigan. So this was a study that we did in Houston, Texas. It was looking at how long it takes people to get to the hospital, because one clear message you should get from tonight is that as soon as you have any symptoms of stroke, the ones that I mentioned, you should immediately call 911 to get to the hospital, because we have very effective treatments, but they only are effective for a couple of hours. So you must immediately call 911, or if you see anybody else having those symptoms, calling 911 is very important. And so again, we did this particular study because we were interested in the delay time it took from when people had symptoms to when they got to the hospital. And we were particularly focused on African Americans and Hispanic Americans because those were the populations that we were studying. And once again, we found a very interesting gender effect by accident. And so this was a study of 241 stroke patients at this large hospital in Houston in the 90s. And what we found was that women got to the hospital slower than men. Okay, now why would women get to the hospital slower than men? Well, many women live alone, and it's hard when you have a symptoms of stroke to pick up the phone and call 911. But the second part of it was especially disturbing when we looked at men and women who got to the emergency department and we controlled for the severity of their symptoms. The doctor saw the men faster than they saw the women. Okay, And the interesting thing about this particular hospital is about 80% of the doctors in the emergency department were women. So can't blame everything on men. Most things, yes, but not this particular one. And so here's the numbers. So in delay in getting to the hospital, it took women 263 minutes on average, so you know more than 4 hours, compared to 200 minutes for men. And then you know once they hit the emergency department, it took doctors 14 minutes to see women and 8 minutes to see men. Now, these you may not be wowed by these absolute differences, but when you have a stroke, we move very quickly in the emergency department. It's the quintessential medical emergency because the medications we have a very short window of efficacy. So we want to treat people as quickly as possible, and there should be no reason that women are seen slower than men are. So in another study, this is now in a population that we've been doing a lot of research for many years in Corpus Christi, Texas, we compared after people have had a stroke and when they're in the hospital, what kind of evaluation they had. Okay, so was there a difference in the evaluation of patients once they had a stroke? And again, in this particular study, we study Mexican Americans predominantly. We found no difference by ethnicity. But again, we found a very interesting gender effect. And so this is where we do our research. And you can imagine this is a really nice place for me to escape in January and February, the Gulf Coast of Texas. It's a great place to do our work. And we've been fortunate to be funded for 15 consecutive years by the NIH to do this work. It's a community of 325,000. About 56% are Mexican American. And so what we found in this study was that women received fewer diagnostic tests than men, despite adjusting for all the clinical reasons why that might be. So we looked at all the neurologic reasons, and we put them all into our analysis. We couldn't figure it out. The doctors there just ordered more tests for the men than they did for the women. We found, very interestingly, that carotid artery disease, which is a common cause of stroke, that the doctors ordered those tests much more for men than they did for women. And we couldn't explain that by anything about the strokes that these people were having. And so our conclusion was that we needed some sort of intervention to increase the access to quality stroke care for women and dispel the myth that stroke is a male disease. So one of the things that we learned in medical school is that vascular disease, heart disease, stroke, those kind of things happen to men. They don't happen to women. And so numbers like 62% of all deaths from stroke occur in women is not a very commonly known fact. And so it's really important that you guys hear this message and that you tell other people about the message so that we can continue to disseminate the idea that stroke is a disease that affects both genders. But we also have to do better in the medical community to make sure that doctors and nurses understand this too. So the next question, do men and women have the same stroke outcome? So clearly, and this is a very interesting fact, this is just adding insult to injury, women do much worse than men when they have a stroke. And we, again, don't know whether this is because of what I just finished saying. Maybe if doctors were more aggressive at treating, evaluating, and preventing stroke in women, they wouldn't have worse outcomes. But we know that stroke outcome is worse in women than it is in men. And so this was a study that was a multinational registry that was reported in 2003. And basically what they found was, and what this number means, is that women were 40% less likely to recover from stroke than men were. That's a huge difference, okay, 40% difference. And there's many reasons that can be possible. The stroke could be more severe. It cannot be evaluated properly. Maybe there's less social support because women are older when they have stroke. There's many different possible reasons for that. But there's also a lot of ways to deal with it. And so we think that it's very important to be aware of these statistics. So back to Canada here for a second to show you a couple of things. It seems that when you cross the border, everything is okay. Because the reports from Canada, and this being one of them reported just a couple of years ago, was that in Canada, the evaluation of men and women are equal. They spend the same amount of money and they do the same number of tests by gender, and the outcome from stroke is also equal. So very, very interesting that our neighbors to the north don't seem to have the same issues that we have here. Okay, so one of the things that I think is really, really important for those of you who interact with the healthcare system, which is probably all of us, is you got to know when to be aggressive and you got to know when to be conservative, okay? And so doing something isn't always the right answer, okay? And we believe very strongly in our stroke program in following the scientific evidence and offering tests and procedures only when it's been shown to be effective and when the risk is worth it, okay? And so here's a very good example of a problem, and that is that when women have blockage in the carotid arteries but have not had symptoms, so we call it asymptomatic, so have not had any of the symptoms that I mentioned before, but they have blockage in the carotid arteries, the data clearly says that a more conservative approach is better than it is for men. Okay, so women do not benefit from surgery for asymptomatic carotid artery disease anywhere as much as men do. Okay, and so most of us are pretty conservative about recommending aggressive treatments. And there's been a series of studies about this, and this is just one of them, that basically shows that if you don't do anything, men are much more likely to have strokes than women are over time. Okay? So are there areas where women, on the other side, should be treated even more aggressively? And the answer to that is acute stroke therapy or in the first few hours after stroke symptoms occur. So once stroke symptoms have occurred, women are especially helped by the medications that we use to treat stroke. And the medication that we use is a drug called TPA or tissue plasminogen activator. It's a substance that our body makes naturally, and a pharmaceutical company has figured out a way to have bacteria make it in big quantities. It's a clot-busting drug. It goes in and breaks open the clot that I told you about, so blood flow can be restored to the brain, and the brain can survive. And so in studies about this, it's been found that that clot-busting drug is much more likely to open up the clot. Here in this study, 94% had the vessel opened up compared to 59% of men, so 94% of women and 59% of men. And in this study, a very interesting study by David Kent, who trained here in Ann Arbor and moved to Boston, he did a study to see who actually benefited the most from TPA for acute stroke. And what he found was that if you look at men, these are the men that got TPA, and these are the men that got a placebo drug. So you know the way we do studies, it's totally without us knowing it. We hang a bag, and we don't know what's in the bag. It could be the real stuff, or it could be a placebo. So the placebo group here and the treated group, for men, there was a very minimal difference. Didn't seem to help all that much. But for women, there was this astounding benefit, right? That there's really a big difference between these bars. And if you look at it really carefully, the interesting thing is that the women who don't get the drug do very badly. The real difference here is the two placebo groups rather than the two treatment groups. And so what this means is if you come to the emergency department within 3 hours, which is when we can give you TPA, and I don't treat you, your chance, if you're a woman, of having recovery is much less than if you're a man. That's really the message from this slide, and David Kent showed this in this very nice study. So a number of different lines of evidence have suggested that once people have a stroke, women don't do as well as men do. Okay, so conclusions. Women have worse stroke outcome than men, pretty clear. Stroke is a larger public health problem in women than men. Okay, stroke symptoms probably do differ. I'm a little cautious here, but they may differ by gender. Okay, they share some commonalities, but women have some extra stuff that may make it difficult for doctors and nurses to determine. So one of the things that we think the reason why doctors don't take care of women as quickly as they do men is they're confused. Okay, men come in, they have, they're paralyzed on one side of their body, their face is drooping, everybody knows it's a stroke. Women come in and they may have those symptoms, but they're also complaining of pain, they have some alteration in consciousness, and the doctor doesn't know what's going on, so it takes longer to do this stuff. All right? So those are some of our theories. And finally, women are treated less aggressively than men. We cannot come up with any explanation for that. That doesn't make any sense, and it's obviously not best medical practice. So those are the conclusions of the research that we and others have done at this point. And so here are some of the speculations. Vascular disease is still thought of as a male disease, both by the public and by the medical community. Physicians are more aggressive with male patients than female patients. Male spouses are worse advocates than women, and or women are more likely to live alone at the time they have a stroke. So both of those things are possible. And as I just finished saying, symptom differences confuse physicians. So how do we fix this? What are the different things that we can do to try to remedy the situation? And so what we do in the stroke program at the University of Michigan is we do a lot of studies like this, epidemiology, where we try to identify the problem. But we have a very involved group that actually goes and tries to work in communities to try to fix the problem. And the community that we do a lot of our work in is this community in Texas because it's geographically isolated. We've been working there a very long time. We'd like to do more in Michigan, and we do a lot of our research in Michigan, but we've gotten most of our data so far from this Texas community. So healthcare intervention research projects that advocate guideline-based practice to all patients. So we need to do better on the medical side. We need to further evaluate symptom differences, and we need more advocacy for women's health and equal care. One of the things that the stroke community has lacked for a long time is an advocacy approach. There are other diseases that we all know of that you can clearly identify the messages and the pink ribbons and a bunch of other things. Stroke, for some reason, has never had that, and I don't understand why. Maybe it's because neurologists are inherently conservative and quiet, but we lack the advocacy, we lack the grassroots citizenry saying, this is important, look what it's done to our community, we need to get the word out. So venues like this are very important. We also have to deliver the proper message, okay? We can't get the message wrong. And I think that in many respects, the agencies that have taken this on, like the Ad Council and the National Institutes of Health and others, have made a serious mistake in stroke education, okay? Just like these guys painting the school sign, they've gotten the name wrong, okay? What these programs have done, and you probably have seen them, is they scare people, okay? And so the Ad Council is famous for that, you know, trying to get kids not to use drugs by taking an egg and frying it in a frying pan. And the behavior research will tell you if you want to prevent a behavior, it's okay to scare people, right? You can scare people out of a behavior, but it's really hard to scare people into a behavior. So for stroke, we want people to call 911 if they have stroke symptoms or they see somebody else having stroke symptoms. And it's hard to scare people into that. By telling people about death and disability and being very bleak, it's not going to happen. So our group has used a very different approach. We've taken people who have done very well after stroke, who have gotten treatment and effectively, you know, got better, and we've promoted that very positive message to the community so that people understand that when you have a stroke, it doesn't mean that you're going to be disabled or die. It means that you need to do something about it and that you really are in control of your own destiny. And so I want to show you some of the work that we've done. So the first bit of work was from a study that we did in rural East Texas, where we took this very positive approach. Instead of showing things very bleak, we showed somebody who came to the emergency department, that there's a friendly doctor, the wife and everybody is encouraged that they call 911 right away. And you can see at the end of this little video that we played on the TV, I think, 1,100 times, the patient actually is recovered and doing the things that, he wants to do.
I think my wife's had a stroke.
I told him not to call.
Would you send an ambulance?
I told him it wasn't necessary. I told him it wasn't an emergency.
It'll be okay.
I told him not to make a fuss.
Are you on any medications?
Now I'm glad he did, because it was a stroke.
If you notice weakness on one side of the body, difficulty speaking or understanding, loss of vision or severe dizziness, call 911.
So again, kind of dealing with the barriers that people don't want ambulances to come to their house and all these other things, and spinning it in a very positive way. So that's a big part of what we're doing. So I want to tell you about another project that we did, and actually, Kate, where are you? Kate Mannix is in the back, and Kate is our nurse practitioner who was very instrumental in this particular project. And she has a lot of information about stroke when we're done, about what we do in our stroke program at U of M and about stroke prevention too. But what we did in this community in Texas is that we decided we needed to train a new generation about stroke symptoms. So we took the message to schools and we taught middle school children about stroke, and we had them through homework assignments bring that information back to their parents. And so here is an interactive computer game where kids learn about stroke and learn about how important it is to call 911 when they see somebody having stroke symptoms. And I want you to notice here that the middle school kid is the hero, and the person who represents the father, uncle, is obviously the villain, comes up with the wrong answer. So this is very much in middle school lingo. All right, so it starts with them at this very typical event that they have in their community, where they are dancing to a local band, and the woman has stroke symptoms. And so the question is, what are the things to do? So if you listen to the uncle here.
I'll take you home so you can rest. You'll probably feel better in the morning.
So that's obviously not the right answer.
I think you should call our doctor to see what the doctor says to do.
So that's not the right answer either, and let's see what the hero would do.
I think we should call 911.
Choose which one you would do.
So if we listen to the uncle and we go home and rest.
Rita went home and slept through the night. In the morning, she was still weak on her right side and was also having trouble talking. Joe took her to the emergency room later that morning. Rita did not get to the hospital in time for TPA. She's still getting better, but will need to get therapy to help improve her speech and to try to walk on her own. Choose which one you would do. Congratulations. Calling 911 is the best thing to do when you see someone who has stroke signs and symptoms. Rita is doing really well because she got TPA quickly. She is leaving the hospital after only a few days. She has no symptoms left from having a stroke.
So you can see the positive and the comparison before she's coming out in a wheelchair, and here she's coming out, you know, holding hands with her husband. So again, a very positive message. I think this is where it gets stuck. Let's see here. These are my aunts trying to remind you that we should be active in this process. So let me end with again going over the symptoms of stroke. Very importantly, sudden blurred or decreased vision, particularly in one eye, a numbness, weakness, or paralysis of the face or one side of the body, maybe just one limb, and maybe arm and leg, difficulty speaking or understanding, unexplained clumsiness, sudden onset of clumsiness, dizziness, or unexplained falling, and severe kind of thunderclap onset of the worst headache of your life. Those are the symptoms of stroke. This is a slide that's now about a decade old, and if anything, I think the problem has gotten worse, and it's always very difficult to compare diseases. All these diseases are very worthy of funding, but stroke always seems to be last in funding and remains so. It's a very discouraging thing because certainly as a population ages, this will continue to be a very, very important disease. For those of us that have taken care of stroke patients who are children, adolescents, young adults, we know that this is not only a disease of the elderly, and it causes very, very severe disability, which is a great expense. No matter how you define that, either it be financially or in terms of great hardship to the patient, the family, and the healthcare system. So that's all I have, and I'm hoping that you guys have lots of questions and comments at this point. Yeah, so are we going to pass around the microphones, or how do you want to? Maybe just raise your hand, and we'll bring the mics to you.
Is there a pharmaceutical intervention like statins help prevent heart attacks? Is there a drug you can take to prevent strokes?
Yeah, so there's so as you guys heard, the question is what are the medical prevention things for strokes? So the first thing I want to say before I talk about the drugs is the most important things you could do to prevent stroke aren't drugs, don't have anything to do with doctors, don't cost any money, right? It's good exercise, proper diet, you know, not smoking, avoiding alcohol, excessive alcohol consumption. So there's not always a medical therapy for all those things. But hypertension, high blood pressure, is the number one cause of stroke throughout the world. And if there's ever a disease that we know how to treat, it's high blood pressure. And as everybody knows here, you have no idea that you have high blood pressure unless you have your blood pressure checked. Okay, so it's really important to get your blood pressure checked frequently. See your physician and try to tell your physician that you want to be very aggressive about getting your blood pressure under good control. Other medications that would be relevant are for people who have diabetes to make sure their sugar is under good control. Statins have been shown to be effective. Statins are cholesterol-lowering medications, a particular type, and they have been shown to be very effective at stroke prevention, too.
Who should be taking the statins? Who should be prescribed statins?
So there are general recommendations for people who have very high cholesterol and people who have had other vascular disease, whether it be heart disease or stroke. And it depends upon the numbers you have of the different subtypes, you know, the total cholesterol, the HDL, and the LDL, and what symptoms and what risk factors you have, whether you've had a stroke or heart attack before. So it's a little bit of a complicated formula, and that's best discussed with your physician. Got to be more.
I have a question.
Yes.
I have a friend whose grandmother was told she had a mini stroke. What is a mini stroke?
So usually a mini stroke is a TIA or a transient ischemic attack, and it's the symptoms of stroke, as we've talked about, that go away within 24 hours. And the concern with that is that you're at really high risk over the next 2 days to a week of having a major stroke where the symptoms stay permanently. So often people make the mistake when they have symptoms, let's say their arm goes dead and it recovers in 5 or 10 minutes, and they say, oh, it's nothing. And they don't go to the hospital, and then they have a major stroke the next day. So those are especially the people we want to see because they have everything to gain by getting prompt medical attention. There's another question up here.
You mentioned that one of the symptoms is when a person has a severe headache, but it's so common to have severe headaches, and you probably will always say, well, it'll go away. I mean, how can you tell the difference with a headache for a stroke and a headache that's normal?
Sure. So the headache that we're talking about is like a thunderclap onset. It just comes out and you feel like you've just been punched in the head. And it's the worst headache of your life, 10 out of 10. So at most, you're going to have one of those in your life, right, if it's the worst headache of your life. But it's a different type of headache than the common ones that people have.
I wonder if there's been any good research yet on aspirin
in preventing stroke in women in particular?
Yeah, so there have been, I think, 150 trials looking at aspirin and the prevention of stroke, and thank you for bringing that up. I neglected to mention that before when I was talking about medical therapies for stroke. Aspirin is an effective preventative treatment for stroke. We know that people who have had a TIA or a stroke before should be on a medication that blocks the platelets, and the aspirin, that's how aspirin works. Platelets are those clumpy things that prevent, that make blood clot, and they should when you, you know, hurt yourself, but they also do it erroneously when people have strokes. So aspirin is an effective preventative treatment. Now, if you have not had a stroke or a heart attack before, it gets a little bit complicated. Aspirin is a good preventative drug for heart attack, but for stroke, it seems to actually work a little bit better or be a little bit safer in women than it is in men. So we actually recommend for primary prevention for women who are, you know, let's say over 60, to take 81 milligrams of aspirin a day for stroke prevention, not necessarily for men, but men take it anyway for heart attack prevention. What?
Never mind ulcers.
Well, it depends. So the question is about ulcers. It depends upon if you've had an ulcer, if you're at risk for an ulcer. If you haven't, then you're okay. But obviously, if you've had an ulcer, that's something to talk to your doctor about.
Dr. Morgenstern, you pointed out a great deal of difference in Canada as far as stroke outcomes. What might your summation be of the reason for that? Could it be a different healthcare system in Canada?
Don't get me started.
That's what we're here for.
If you want to talk about healthcare reform, we could be here all night. So I don't know. Obviously, Canadians have a very different healthcare system. We spend a lot more money per capita on healthcare here. They may not be doing the tests anyway, so it's hard to tell. Just because it's equal in Canada doesn't mean Canada is doing it better than we are. And so we don't know the answer to that. Good question.
Here's it.
Yes, Sue, you described women as having a different kind of symptoms, and several of the women in my family have had strokes, and they never have the classic symptoms. How did you describe them? How did you say women describe those?
So I think the important thing is that, at least our opinion is that both men and women do have the classic symptoms, but women have other stuff that kind of masks the classic symptoms. And so the other stuff that I was talking about is what we label as an alteration in consciousness or altered mental status. So they're kind of sleepy, they may pass out, they're just not with it. Okay. Usually when people have a stroke, they're awake and alert. Okay. They may not be saying the right things, they may slur their speech, they may be confused, but their eyes are open and they're awake. So stroke doesn't usually cause people to pass out. That's usually, when I hear, when somebody calls from the emergency department and tells me that somebody has passed out, I usually am thinking that that's not a stroke. And 9 times out of 10, I'm right about that. But women may have more of a propensity to have those changes in consciousness. They may also complain of pain. So when a limb is paralyzed, you know, men may be more likely to say it doesn't work. Women may be more likely to say it hurts. So that's an interesting description. And from a research standpoint, we don't know if women have different symptoms or they describe them differently or what the situation is. But it's enough that I think that we've now found it in two very different populations, one in Texas, one in Ann Arbor. And I think it's enough to kind of throw off both the patients and the doctors in making the proper diagnosis. Yes?
Two questions. One is, if it's not a question of description,
just talk right into it.
You're good. Sorry. If it's not a question of description, what would be the reason for having different symptoms? Is it hormones? Is it what? That's one question. And the second question is,
you got to ask me one at a time because I can't remember more than one. if it's not a description, it could be that different parts of the brain cause different feelings. In other words, if on the left side of my brain, if that's blocked, it may cause me to be, you know, to feel numbness. For you, it may cause pain. And so it may just be that that is a gender difference. And so, you know, that's why I was saying that I don't know if it's a description thing, if it's more of a psychological thing, or if it's more of an anatomy, physiology thing. So that's a possibility. I don't think that hormones play a role here. Hormones are very important in this story, and I haven't talked about them. But we know that estrogen seems to be protective of stroke in women early on, but can also, but you know, when estrogen levels decrease around menopause, it causes the risk of stroke to go up in women.
And you led into the second question very well. What studies are there about the onset of the first stroke in men versus women?
Right. So at any given age, men have a higher risk of stroke than women. Okay, and we think that the 62% of deaths from stroke occur because women live longer than men, okay? And men die from a bunch of other things, from heart disease, from cancer. Women live longer, and because they live longer, they're likely to have a stroke. But I think that women are relatively protected because of hormonal levels. I should also say that hormone replacement, though, seems to have the opposite effect. And there have now been several studies that suggest that hormone replacement is not good. It increases the risk of stroke. And certainly when we see women who are on hormone replacement or on oral contraceptives and have strokes, we stop them immediately.
First, I'd like to thank you and your colleagues for all the work that you're doing in this area. A year ago, I had a stroke, and I'm just wanting to comment that the drug that they gave me, the TPA, is very effective, and I have very limited side effects now that most people don't even recognize. But I just wanted to thank you for that.
Dr. Morgenstern, you talked about the funding that's going into research and the hope that there's more advocacy. Where do you see research going? Where, if we had more money going into research, what are the opportunities for research?
So, that's another kind of, you know, all evening kind of discussion. I mean, I think that, I think we've made some mistakes, actually, with the money that is around. There have been hundreds of studies of different new chemicals to treat stroke, but very few people try to get people in the hospital fast enough to use the good chemical we have right now. And so I'm a big proponent of doing research in communities with people and trying to get them treated with existing therapies. As I started this, I said, I think we know a lot about stroke, but we're not using it. So I'd like to see a lot more community-based research. I'd like to see a lot more effort in trying to prevent stroke and get stroke treated. We have another large study that is funded by the government where we've partnered with a Catholic church to try to spread a prevention message to a Mexican-American community in Texas. And we're very hopeful that will be helpful. And I think also, you know, so those would be my highest priorities. My next priorities would be to continue the basic science work that we're doing, genetics, et cetera, to try to figure out, you know, why this all happens and come up with better therapies. I think to an extent, and I try to allude to this with the first question, we tend to look for magic pills to fix things. And I think a clear message is that we all have to take responsibility for our own health and try to do the things that we should do to prevent the disease from happening. Or once it's happened, take care of each other in our community. I mean, I hope that, you know, if I have a stroke in Ann Arbor, that somebody's going to witness it and pick up the phone and call 911.
Lewis, I just wanted to follow up with a comment. You know, the grant that's sponsoring this evening and a whole series of these community forums that we're doing is because it's so critical that our communities get involved in clinical research. Clinical research can't happen without the involvement of all of you. Can you comment if there's any clinical research studies going on right now that people may want to look up on our Engage website or contact you about?
Yeah, I fortunately, I think for healthy people, there aren't. We have a number of different research projects that are going on for people who have had strokes. And I don't know, Kate Maddox, you have anything more to say about that? Right.
Because different studies come up at different times, so there may not be a study today, but there may be a study 6 months from now or a year from now, one of the things that we've done with the Engage website, where there's brochures out in the forum area there, is there's a registry where you can register yourself. It's completely private. No one else gets access to the information except for the people who are conducting the studies that you might be interested in. And then if a study comes online in the future, you will be contacted about that study. So you don't have to be checking every day. It will let you know. And it's not just stroke studies. There are studies in every possible health concern that you can imagine going on. So the registry is a wonderful way to, and the thing is that it's just for your information. If you get contacted and you have no interest at all in participating, you don't have to do anything. So it's a way to keep informed if you want to get involved.
Okay. We have another question right here.
Is there a chemical explanation as to why sodium seems to have such an effect on blood pressure?
So good chemistry question. Why does sodium affect blood pressure? I don't know the answer to that, because the body is usually pretty good at regulating sodium. It's the kidneys that are responsible for modulating how much sodium we have in the body. But we do think that sodium is an important part of blood pressure and of stroke. And as a matter of fact, this project that I mentioned, where we're trying to do primary prevention in our partnership with the Catholic Church, the prime thing is to try to get people to eat less sodium. So we know it's important, but why the kidneys kind of fail in getting rid of sodium and retain enough so that the blood pressure goes up is something that I don't know the answer to.
You talked about advertising messages. And for a long time prior to this seminar, I was remembering the messages that talk about a brain attack being the same, like a heart attack, except of the brain. So I was under the impression they were the same process and basically the same doctors treated both. And I noticed you kept talking about neurology. I kept thinking, well, it was cardiology that treated all these things. Is there a difference?
Yeah.
Are they the same?
Right. So a heart attack or a myocardial infarction is the heart, and a stroke or a brain attack is the brain. I think that, medicine continues to realign itself, and it used to be that cardiologists took care of the heart and neurologists took care of the brain. So my office is in the cardiovascular center of the hospital, and I have a lot more in common with my cardiologists down the hall than I do with neurologists in the other building. So we basically take care of blood vessels, and whether the blood vessels are in the heart or in the brain, it's that sort of thing. We're the plumbers of the body.
You speak about how important it is to get to the hospital quickly within that two-hour period, but I think that maybe one of the reasons that women don't do this is because they don't want to be accused of being hypochondriacs or pampering themselves or something like that. And you sit there and you think, geez, I feel awful, but am I having something? Or should I go to the hospital? Or should I just take an aspirin and go lay down? Or what should I do? And I live alone, and I think a great many women live alone, and lots of times I'll have some funky feeling, and I think, am I having something? Or what's going on with me? And I do nothing except take an aspirin and go lay down.
Okay, let me see if I can answer this one. So we're not talking about funky feelings. We're talking about things that I think are pretty recognizable. Of the thousands and thousands of stroke patients I've taken care of, I've yet to meet one who said, I didn't know what it was. Okay, a lot of people say before they've had it, I'm not quite sure what it is, and I'm not so sure what the symptom is, but after you've had it, you know what it is. Now, there are mild strokes, and I just finished saying that with mini strokes or mild strokes, it's really important to get to the hospital because it could be a harbinger of a major stroke. for people who live alone, I think some of those devices that you carry with you or wear that you can push a button and ask for help, you laugh at it, but they can be lifesavers, and it's really important. And the opportunity to be able to get help when you need it. The problem with stroke, okay, and we did a study I did not talk about, is that over 95% of the time when somebody has a stroke, they can't call for 911 themselves, right? By the nature of the disease, right? You can't speak, you can't move. How are you going to get to the phone, right? So having something where you can push a button and ask for help is, really important. So, my goal is to try to get everybody in the community to know about it so that when people have a stroke in the supermarket or, somewhere else, they can ask for help. But if you're in your house by yourself, it doesn't work. You gotta have something that you have with you that you can use. Yes? Well, so remember, strokes occur on one side of the body. So if you had a cell phone with you and you could call 911, as you know, the way... So cell phones are a little bit difficult, and it depends upon where you are. It's harder for them to triangulate it. Your home phone with your, they can always figure out where you are and get to you. So cell phones are probably not good enough.
Just a plug for the Huron Valley Ambulance group that we have here. They do offer an inexpensive package, like an insurance plan. So if you want to not have to think about how much an ambulance visit will cost you to get to the hospital or not, because cost is certainly a factor for some people, they have a plan at which you pay a certain amount a year, which gives you unlimited hospital ambulance trips. They also have a service where you can rent that red button that you press when you need it. So cost being a factor for many people, those are some resources you have in your community.
How can you clearly differentiate between your arm going to sleep and mostly when you're in bed or a stroke coming on?
Right. So I don't know if the mic was on, but the question is, how can you tell your arm going to sleep from a stroke coming on? So I think the key way is that stroke is a loss of function. So when I lie in my arm at night and it goes to sleep, it's tingly. And it's kind of an active feeling, and I can move it. Like I get up, I move it, and it starts feeling better pretty quickly. It doesn't feel very good for a while, but it takes time. With a stroke, there's a loss of sensation. Sometimes people do have a little bit of tingling, but usually it's just numb. And it doesn't get better when you shake it, right? So if it doesn't get better, in the first 60 seconds, which I think when your limb is asleep, it's going to get better. You're going to get more and more feeling. Then you need to call 911.
Dr. Morgenstein, thank you very much for this evening. Also, as a New Yorker, you have a mayor that is trying to do some very innovative things as far as salt restriction and salt intake. New York Times recently had some articles where they showed what some of the restaurants, fast food and others, if you would just go in and, quote, have a simple meal, you're already going way over what you should have for a daily intake of salt, which I think is 2,000 milligrams or something like that. What would you project for people, for health, if salt is so important and influences blood pressure? What can we do to make it better for everyone? The mayor in New York is trying one way. Is that a good way?
Right. So... So I'm an Ann Arborite. When I go to New York, my blood pressure goes up 20 points just from at the first time the first taxi cab honks at me. Yes, thank you. Those are excellent points. And so we actually, our group got very famous last year because we wrote this paper about the association of fast food restaurants with stroke that some of you may have read about in the media and heard on CNN, et cetera. And so what in this community in Texas, what we found was the closer you live to a fast food restaurant, the higher your stroke risk is, or the density of fast food restaurants in your neighborhood was directly related to your stroke risk. And so fast food has a tremendous amount of salt and fat and carbohydrate and those types of things. And We just have to make healthier choices, you know, and healthier choices, we have those opportunities all the time. It's what you eat, it's, you know, do I walk to work or drive to work? Do I take a bike? Do I go out for a walk at lunch or have another Big Mac? I mean, there are many choices that we can make. It's hard to legislate them, okay? And so I think that, you know, various people have made attempts both locally and on national levels to think about legislating healthy behavior, cigarettes, all types of things. You can tax them, and I must say that I'm not a politician, but if I was, I think a good thing to do would be to make fast food that is not healthy more expensive than good food. As we know, it is more expensive to buy a healthy meal than it is to buy a not healthy meal. And as long as that happens, you know, if it's cheaper and faster, it's hard to say don't do it. So very, very good ideas and good points and things we need our politicians to improve. Okay. Oh, one more.
Right over there. Let me get.
A little bit off the topic, but I understand there's a geographical difference too in strokes, and I'm just curious why this stroke belt is it all the salt and fat down in the southeast?
Yeah, so very good question. So there is a stroke belt and a stroke buckle of the belt. The southeast of the United States has a much higher risk of stroke than anywhere else. New York State, I think, has the lowest stroke rates in the country. So we don't know what the reasons are. In preliminary examinations, it doesn't appear to be related to race, ethnicity, hypertension, diet, but it's hard to do those ecological type studies and figure out exactly what's going on. There's a large study going on that's funded by the NIH called REGARDS right now that's trying to understand a little bit of the geographic predilection for stroke. Michigan is somewhat in the middle of the risk. Okay, well, Kate Mannix and I will be around for a little bit longer if you have any questions.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you very much, Dr. Mannix.